Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Could start in Italian, but that seems a bit silly because this was in English.
True, good point.
So I'll say instead, hello and welcome back. It's been too long since we teased you with one episode of this new season and then basically disappeared for a month, but we're back and we are here with our second episode in this masked superhero comic book season, whatever we're calling it. I'm all over the place today. My name is Adrian and I am joined by my co-host and one might say the king of criminals himself. It's Rod Barnett.
Hello, Adrian. My friends call me Diabolicus. But I have no friends, so there.
Yeah, it's so weird that the Italian title for I think it's the second film is The King of Criminals. But he's not. He's like the hero. It's very strange. Anyway.
I thought the Italian title was like Super Argo Contra Diabolicus.
The second film, The Faceless Giants. I think it's called Il Re di Criminali. Super Argo. The King of Criminals is Super Argo. I mean, King of Wrestlers, maybe?
I don't know.
He's definitely, we'll get to this, but he's a wrestler and he cheats an awful lot, in my opinion.
Oh, really? Well, that opens up an entire discussion. Hold on.
We'll get to that. So, yes, welcome back, everybody. And we are here ready to talk about superheroes and supervillains again. Now, one thing I wanted to mention, because I've been forgetting to do this the last few episodes, is the podcast is now also available on YouTube. And so if you just search for Wild Wild Podcast on there or find the links on our feeds, then you will also see that you can listen along. I don't know why, like, YouTube is a video site, but audio content seems to be just as popular. So, yes,
yeah,
the entire back catalogue is now there on YouTube. And I should say that since I did this just before Christmas, we've had about 4,000 hits. So that's not bad, is it?
Well, that's not bad. How many episodes have you gotten up? All of them?
There's about 50-something.
Okay, yeah. Good.
Would you like to guess, Rod? Let's play a little game. Would you like to guess what the most popular episode is on YouTube?
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to take a wild guess and say one of the science fiction films, maybe, Wild Planet?
Now, you would hope that people were finding our podcast because they were searching for top quality chat on cult Italian cinema.
Oh my.
But bear in mind that there's a lot of people searching for smut on YouTube.
The hell you say.
I know, it surprises me too. So with that in mind, what might our most popular film be, do you think?
Oh my god, smut? Yeah. I'm having to cast my mind back over the films we've covered. Which one had the maximum amount of at least potential smut?
I don't.
Yeah, I don't know which one that would get picked out of the lot.
Let me put you out of your misery. So most of the episodes that I've put up have all had between 100 and 200 views, but then way out on top with 2,500 views is Il Racconti di Viterbi, aka the Sexbury Tales.
Oh my goodness, you're kidding me.
I know. Oh. Right, there you go.
Oh, your instincts that a mini season of films about naked Italian women really has paid off.
I know. Just, it was a hunch. What can I say?
Yeah, a hunch. In other words, I want to talk about naked Italian women from the 70s, yeah. Rod. Let's get on
there. There you go. So, yes, if you haven't checked out what is now, by a country mile, our most popular episode, then do go back and listen to our episode on the... We did a whole sort of mini-season of Canterbury Tales, Arabian Nights, all of that Decameron trilogy films, which was good fun. Anyway, there you go. So if you're not subscribed to us on YouTube, please do, because I think the more subscribers we get, the more, you know, people love. Find us.
The more love we get. I don't know.
Although clearly people are finding us all right without that, or at least they're finding that one episode. But anyway.
Well,
do subscribe.
Let's admit right up front that clearly we should point out that we, as podcasters, are essentially seeking attention from the public because we lack a firm base of a real personality in our own lives, and we feel that if we don't get that affirmation from people outside of our immediate families, then we will curl up and die. So please pay attention to us.
Yes. And, of course, I mean, I don't know about you, but I can't really speak to my immediate family about any of this crap. So I have to do it here.
Well, I luckily, to only one member, really. I mean, and she'll be trapped in the car and can't escape into another room. Yeah, so she has to listen to me at times. So
fair enough. Now, so one of the reasons that we have been missing for a month is because shortly after we recorded that first episode, another commentary track opportunity dropped into our laps.
Yes.
But it had to be done in about a week or two weeks maybe.
Yeah,
we turned it around in about 2 weeks. So, and then I had to go on a trip to the Middle East for work, which was pretty cool, I have to say.
But it's something he can't talk about. It's super secret because the government will come and take him away if he speaks about it.
So, yeah, it's been a pretty busy start to the year. Now, that commentary track, it hasn't been announced yet.
No.
So I think all we can say, we could say something. We could just say it's for basically a long-lost horror film. I mean, I would say it was pretty much lost, wouldn't you?
Let's put it this way. If I put it this way, this will vague it up pretty hard.
Okay.
It's a film that I had seen before, and therefore recommended that we talk about it. But the way in which I had seen it felt like I was watching a third generation VHS copy with some subtitles. And so this coming soon to a retailer near you is an amazing upgrade of a 70s Spanish horror film. Let's put it that way.
Oh, there we go. That's narrowed it down a little bit. Speaking of Spanish, let's get to our films for today. So, because they are Spanish co-productions, which does have some impact, I think, on why they are the way they are and who the cast is and all of that.
Yep.
So we are, of course, talking about the masked superhero Super Argo.
Thank you.
Actually, the music I stuck in there is the Super Argo theme from the second film, Super Argo and the Faceless Giants, because that one is more fun. It's like a kind of Batman-style theme. But some of the music in the first film, Super Argo versus Diabolicus, sounds very James Bond-like, to the point where you might think that Eon would be considering suing the filmmakers.
It is very close, it's true.
Yeah, I'll drop a little bit of that in here too, because you can hear just how Bondy this actually is. We might talk about the music a bit more later, but just like to stick a bit in there at the beginning. So, yeah, Super Argo, two films made about 2 years apart by two different directors, but the same lead actor. Not that it makes that much difference, because we deliberately never see his face. And, yeah, Rod, what is your history with the Super Argo films?
Caught up with at least one of them, the first one, I do believe, years ago, because of course any you know, as soon as you see something like Diabolic from Bava, you want to root around in that genre a little bit, and it's a pretty shallow pool. There aren't a whole lot of them, so I was able to see a good number of them, even when it was, you know, the gray market and bootlegs, things of that nature. And so my history with the Super Argo films is consistently getting them confused with each other and trying to remember which one was the first one and which one was the second one. It's not helped by the fact that the second one almost pretends the first one doesn't exist. But the joys of them are multitudinous, and it wasn't until I can't remember exactly when I realized that the Super Argo films were essentially a kind of European answer to the El Santo-style films from Mexico. But because there are a lot of similarities. But my history with them is thinking that until just a few years ago, thinking that they were worth a single watch, but not worth revisiting. I have changed my tune over the past 5 or 6 years. And I will say that I do have, believe it or not, what I think is a Spanish or Mexican, probably Mexican, lobby card for the second film.
Oh, nice.
Framed on my wall. It was a gift from a dear friend of mine who has since passed on. He gave it to me probably more than 20 years ago now. And it has pride of place to my left currently on the wall in my office. And so my history with the Super Argo films is, first was a big, all right. And nowadays, I'm a big fan and really hope that eventually both of these films come out in some kind of nice Blu-ray set that will give them a lot of extras that place them in their historical perspective.
Nice. Can you send me a photo of that, and I can put it on our Instagram?
Yeah, sure, of course. I'll do that later today.
Now, it's interesting that you mention, of course, the El Santo, the masked wrestler connection here, because this is a although it's an Italian, is written by Italians, but it was a co-production with the Spanish market, and there was very much an eye towards marketing it to Spanish-speaking countries, because Italy's never really been into wrestling, whereas wrestling was huge in Spain, which I think is why they make him a wrestler in the first place. But also, even the name, so I didn't know this until I was reading this up in Roberto Curti's book Diabolica, which I'm referencing quite a lot this season. And he mentions here how El Santo, the film, there were only a few films that were shown in Italy of El Santo's films, but they changed his name in the Italian versions to Argos, because they didn't want, apparently, they didn't want filmgoers to confuse El Santo with the Simon Templar, the saint, film. sort of.
Yes.
I'm not sure if it was the Roger Moore ones, I guess it must have been the Roger
Roger Moore played in the Saint
in the mid-60s.
Yeah. And it was a pretty popular thing in a lot of different countries for a long period of time.
Yeah, it was called Il Santo in Italy. So Santo's name was changed to Argos, and so Super Argo was originally the title while it was in production was Super Argos.
Hmm.
So it was very deliberately based on Santo. And this is where I get to my point about him being a massive cheat at wrestling. So at the beginning of the film, we start out in the wrestling ring, and he accidentally kills his fellow wrestler, who turns out to be a close friend.
Mm-hmm.
And he's feeling terrible guilt about this, and he's going to quit wrestling and all that. And then he immediately gets recruited to be a secret agent. To prove how good a secret agent he could be, they show how he's basically... super strong, you can freeze him, you can burn him, he's impervious to pretty much everything except electricity. So, and they never really explain where all that power comes from.
Oh, but yes, they do.
Do they? Did they I miss
us,
something?
They give us a line of complete BS to try to make everyone just go along with it. I will quote. Oh,
what? I missed it.
It's the somatic configuration of Super Argo's organism is identical to that of any normal human, but his metaphysical equilibrium is so perfectly balanced that it gives him superhuman resistance. So there, see? Complete explanation.
How did I forget that? Well, look, to me, that's basically...
Because it's technobabble.
It's basically cheating, right? Surely. If he's impervious to all that stuff, he's effectively like he's on steroids. He shouldn't be allowed to fight normal humans when he can, you know, clearly he's better than all of them. So I think he's a bit of a cheat, personally. And he's,
well, that's an interesting way to look at it. I hadn't really considered the that aspect.
It's not exactly a fair fight.
Well, yeah, but and what's weird is that, okay, so in this movie he's wrestling a guy who does turn out to be his to have been a friend of his who he accidentally kills. So one would think that his buddy who he's in the ring with would have known how, you know, how impressive a physical specimen he is. So, you know, gentleman's agreement here, you know, we're doing an entertainment, right?
Yeah.
So this is an even sadder thing, because clearly if this guy was Super Argo's friend and he accidentally kills him, this is a deep dark hurt, and points to the reason why this movie really is very different from all those El Santo and Blue Demon and Mil Máscaras films from Mexico, because this is Super Argo has feelings, folks. He's got dimensions.
Also, although I don't pick up on this at all, but maybe I missed it, just like I missed that other bit. Apparently, he's also a concentration camp survivor.
That's
part of his backstory, according to Roberto Curti.
Now I'm forgetting. Okay, so if that's in there, I have in my two recent viewings of it completely zoned right out on that one.
Maybe that's only in the Italian language version.
I don't know.
Because I completely missed that, if that's true. But yeah, so a complex kind of dark backstory for Super Argo. But before we get more into him, should we just talk a little bit about the director and some of the cast, and then we'll get into the plot. So this film is directed by Nick Nostro, which is a great name. And a director that I was not formally familiar with, but I quite enjoyed looking through his list of credits. He was a second assistant director on a load of interesting things, including a couple of films by our favourite duo, Franco and Chicho.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So he did a couple of those. He did a kind of James Bond one, Secret Agents Against the Three Enemies, as assistant director. And then one called Two Samurai for 100 Geisha. And you can guess who the two samurai are, of course. So...
he was assistant director on those.
Assistant director on those. And then he directed only... I mean, for somebody working in genre cinema in the 60s, he didn't actually make that many films. In about a 10-year period, he only made 10 films.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas some directors are making, you know, 10 in a year. That's not very many. But, you know, is he a director whose work you're familiar with before, apart from Super Argo?
Well, I had not paid attention to his name until sitting down to really think about these Super Argo films. But it turns out, of the 10 films he's listed as director on, I've seen 4 of them. So,
okay.
Yeah, I've seen Revenge of the Black Knight, Spartacus and the 10 Gladiators, Operation Counter Spy, and this one. Which okay. means that, you know, if I really wanted to work hard, I could just go ahead and see all of the films that he supposedly directed. So there's that.
Yeah, and then it looks like he just took early retirement, I think.
I don't know what happened with him. Some people on this, on these two films, it's easy to determine why their career stopped at a certain point because, for instance, one of the composers passed away. And so that's why his career stops at a certain point.
Yeah.
But the I'm not sure exactly what he did. I'm not sure if he moved into some kind of different status in the film industry.
Yeah, I've tried. Well, he originally went to university and studied law.
Mm-hmm.
So his nickname was the professor, because he was qualified and sort of considered to be studious, I suppose. But I haven't been able to find any evidence as to whether that's what he went back into, so I'm not entirely sure. But yeah, he stopped directing at the age of 40, but then he lived for another 40 years after that, so not really sure. But the last film that he made was... I've mentioned this on the podcast before, how there's a load of these Italian sex comedies with hints of incest. This just seemed to be a common thread. So his last film is called Grazie Zio, Ci Provo Anche Io, which means thank you, uncle, I'll try too. Oh, so my. I'm not entirely sure if that is another one of these, but just the fact there's an uncle in the title, and the poster is a mustachioed Italian man, presumably the uncle, with a young, beautiful, naked girl in bed, just makes you wonder whether...
it does.
So, yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. Anyway, I don't think we'll be rushing to do that as a mini season anytime soon.
Incestuous sex comedies.
Yeah. Well, now you put it like that, maybe. But anyway, yeah.
Suddenly you're enticed? I'm worried.
Well, now you can put if you could put it into 3 words, then it sounds quite snappy. So apart from being the professor and passing away just about 10 years ago, I can't really tell you anything about Nick Nostro. But as we said, this is a Spanish co-production, so I did wonder if there are any Nashi connections here with the cast or anyone else involved that you were aware of.
Quite a number. Of course, we'll start with the title character himself, Diabolicus, Gerard Tichy, and I'm never sure if I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. He had an amazing career. If you've ever seen a movie that had people speaking in a non-English European language, you probably have seen him somewhere. He worked with Nashi in several films. He was in The Beast and the Magic Sword. Yes.
Nice. And I think that's one of the few Nashi films I've actually seen.
Oh, well, you should, as I have said to you on many occasions,
yes.
See more. But
yes.
But Gerard Tichy had an incredible career in Spanish films. He was also with Nashi in the film known as The Hanging Woman, it goes by a dozen other names as well. But the thing about this particular actor is he was very much beloved and... very well thought of. You can also see him in some other great Spanish horror films like The Corruption of Chris Miller, in Bava's Hatchet for the Honeymoon, and which, you know, Spanish Italian co-production. Nevertheless, but also some really great spaghetti westerns as well. One of my favorites, Compañeros, he's in, and Bullet for Rommel. Sartana Does Not Forgive. Quite a few, but he's a really good actor, and it would not be much of a stretch to say that he's one of those actors who, even though he was in a 1960s Jess Franco film, was also in films like Dr. Zhivago. So he kind of strode the line between bigger American productions being produced in Europe I mean, he plays Jesus's dad in King of Kings, so give the man some credit.
And he's in the Blanchville Monster, which did you write about that one for the Arrow? In the Arrow box set.
No, I didn't write about that one. Troy and I covered about it. The other one. Troy and I covered it over on the Nashie Cast because it has so many Nashie connections beyond just Gerard. Heck of a film. Kind of a slightly different variation on the standard Gothic stuff, but he's a really fine actor, and like I say, was in a lot of different kinds of films, and he lends real credibility and gravitas to this movie. I can't escape talking about him without mentioning his role in the legendary Pieces as well.
Of course.
So yes. So people, Pieces. If you ain't seen it, you're missing out.
He's also, of course, in Mystery on Monster Island. Let's not forget that one.
Oh, and well, The Sea Serpent as well. One of the last films that he did. The last Amando D'Osorio film, and I'll praise Amando D'Osorio, but not praise that film probably.
So. What an incredible life he had. He was because he was German originally, lieutenant in the army in World War II, when he was captured and held in a prison of war camp in France. He managed to escape and fled to Spain, and then just spent the rest of his life in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty amazing.
Now, as for the rest of the cast, as you might expect for a Spanish co-production, quite a few connections there as well. The Diabolicus's lovely girlfriend, played by Lordana Nusicki? Okay, I'm going to blow it. Nusak?
I would say Nusjak.
Nusjak. Okay, good.
Yeah, I could also be wrong. It's an unusual name, considering she is Italian, and that's not an Italian name, Nusjak.
I know.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, she's from Trieste, which is sort of over there on the border with, so maybe her father was from somewhere else, but yeah, anyway, sorry.
Oh, well, no. I mean, she's in a number of things that people might recognize her from, not least of which would be Django.
Django. Mm. Yeah, is she the girl that he rescues at the beginning of the film?
She's the one that kind of becomes his girlfriend through the film, yeah. And not only that, she's also in a few other films that people might have known, mainly because one of them, $10,000 Blood Money, has now been released on Blu-ray.
Yes, so by Arrow, I think.
Yes, so that one's easier to see, and she's the main female actress. She's the main actress in that film, and that film I can highly recommend. Now that I've seen that one, that one's a hidden little spaghetti western gem, in my opinion. Mm. But she was in several films. Her career is mostly in the 60s. And then kind of goes away. I'm assuming that she's one of those actresses who, once you got... See, although she worked intermittently throughout the 70s, I suspect that she decided to go and do something different at a certain point. And I'm assuming that may have been raising a family. But you never can tell.
Mm.
But she is a lovely lady and acquits herself quite effectively in this film as well as the other films that I've seen her in.
Yeah.
There's also Monica Randall, who plays Super Argo's girlfriend, and she has a bigger role in this than you might think, mainly because if you've got a girlfriend, then guess what? You've got leverage over your hero. You can torture the girlfriend, make the superhero do whatever you want him to do, and so that's, of course, her position in this film, sad to say.
But it's almost like they're kind of expecting her to get kidnapped, because they make a special brooch with a camera in it that she can wear so that he could, like, because they give this to him. They give him all these weird gadgets, and one of them is this shiny brooch with a camera. I'm like, I was thinking, well, what's he going to do with that? And then, of course, it's obvious. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Well, Monica Randall turned up in a number of films that people might have seen, including 1971's Red Sun with Charles Bronson and an international cast there. But she's also in the excellent Giallo, My Dear Killer, And she was in Pancho Villa, another Spanish film. But for Spanish horror fans, she is prominent in The Witch's Mountain, the Cross of the Devil, which was a film that was written by Paul Naschy but directed by someone else. And then she turns up in a prominent role in Naschy's first directorial film, Inquisition, in 1976, and had a fairly long career, as a matter of fact. She seems to have found her niche and have been in quite high demand on Spanish television, working up to last year still doing things. And so Monica Randall, thumbs up.
Just in another attempt to plug your work, didn't you do a commentary for Inquisition?
Yes, actually, Troy Gwynn and I did. That was our first commentary was for Inquisition.
Oh, nice.
That's where we learned that we could do this without shaking in our seats. So yes,
and of course she's also, just to bring it back to some giallo, she's in My Dear Killer, which is the film that starts with that amazing decapitation by Digger. Which is that's quite a film.
It's a heck of a film. Recommended if you've never seen it.
I like that one a lot. Good, yeah. So there we go. So I think that's pretty much all of the main cast, except of course our main man himself, Ken Wood.
Yeah.
AKA Giovanni Cianfrillia. But as you've talked about before, it's great when they give these guys kind of American sounding names. Ken Wood.
Kenwood, generic American.
Yeah.
Yeah, you and I have talked about him a little bit because he's got a role in Castle of Blood. Not to toot our own horns there, but of course we did a commentary track for that.
Yeah.
We did a commentary track together for Castle of Blood, and so we talked a little bit about this particular actor / primarily stuntman. He plays Super Argo in both the films, and of course you never see his face. And I have to admit that's kind of strange. It's not. I love the conceit, but it's not as if the guy was ugly or anything.
I know. There's one bit where they take his mask off and they all go, but they won't show us. We're like, well, what?
Well, yeah. I mean, we can't tell from their reaction if he's hideously scarred or insanely handsome. We don't know.
Yeah. There's a bit when, I forget which film, already the films have become one big film in my head. At the end, there's this whole thing where it's only, only his girlfriend has actually seen his face.
Right.
And then at the end of the film, she says, oh, well, we've beaten the bad guy, so you might as well take your mask off now. In this boat full of people. And he's like, oh, yes. And he just whips it off. I'm like, well, that didn't take much.
It's as if, you know, mission over, face can come out to play. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, one of his greatest credits that I think we cannot let go unmentioned is he is one of the fighting football players in the Mr. Hercules versus Karate, the Antonio Margheriti hilarious comedy set in Hong Kong.
One of us finds it hilarious, people.
No, even I don't. I have to admit, it's pretty painful.
It's awful. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's Antonio Margheriti made a few films that I think are absolutely awful, but that one's almost completely unredeemable. It's just terrible.
The fight scene in the Chinese restaurant with the American football team is pretty funny. And so I guess he's one of those. Because, as well as acting, he's got a huge list of credits as a stunt guy.
Yeah.
Up to this this century, I should say, like Gangs of New York, he's in.
Long list of credits.
Pretty cool. Loads of things that people will have seen. Last Temptation of Christ, for example. Even in Luigi Cozzi's Hercules. And a few of the other films we did, like 2019, After the Fall of New York, that we've talked about before. So, quite a guy. Not necessarily the greatest actor, but didn't have to be.
Exactly. it's his physical acting that they're wanting here in the first place. I mean, I think the director of the first film basically said, he knew how limited an actor this guy was, and so he took great pains to find a really good dubber for him. And I'm assuming that he's talking about the Italian version of it. But I think the English dubber did an excellent job as well. Mm-hmm. Where we're looking at this guy who's physically really presents very well, and in the action scenes, and even just in moving around with the actors and speaking the lines and you know doing the standard things, the stuff that the blocking with the other actors, it all looks very fluid. He looks like the athlete and man of action that he really is.
Yeah.
And so that, if you're going to hire a guy for that kind of thing, it makes sense. And he does the job required. And I think that, it's probably for the best that he wasn't required, even in the first film, to kind of present a lot of, shall we say, emotional content on his face. If he wasn't capable of it, they may have gone in that direction for many reasons, and that may be one of them.
Yeah, and I mean, we don't even see that much of his face because of his mask, but they haven't quite gone... It's like they tried to find a compromise. They haven't gone full diabolic.
So well, they change his mask in the second film.
Yeah, the second one is better, because the first one... It kind of covers his whole face, but there's a big hole for his mouth and big holes for his eyes, which just has the unfortunate side effect. Like when it's standing slightly further away, it kind of looks like, he's doing Al Jolson.
God. Well, I hadn't thought about that. But yes, it is a black mask. And in the first film, it does, from far enough away, it could look like some person doing blackface. I hadn't thought about that. Now I'll never be able to avoid that image. Thank you, Adrian.
You're welcome. So that's why I think the second film, the mask is better, because it just covers his eyes this time and leaves the rest of his face uncovered.
Well, I mean, do we want to dig into the plots of these two films? We could at least just go over them briefly and kind of differentiate between them a little.
I'm just going to say up front, I think the first film is better than the second film.
And I'm going to disagree with you, and ooh. I'm shocked to be able to say that, but that is
okay.
Yeah, that is where I fell, and I may be in the minority here, but I will be able to explain why.
Okay. Yeah. And we should also say, as you mentioned before, basically neither of these films are currently legally available.
Which
is a real shame. So, I mean, maybe my viewing was slightly sort of affected by that. So the first film, I have a DVD... which I think comes from an Italian DVD from like 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's because it's got the choice of Italian or English language. And it's widescreen and it looks really nice. But then the second film, which is the one that's more easy to find, it's on YouTube.
Yeah.
But the once you get past the opening credits, it's been cropped to 4:3. But they've just cropped off the sides. And there's quite a lot of good use of widescreen in the second film, where you've got objects on both sides or people talking to each other on both sides of the frame, and all we can see is the middle and just two noses poking into the frame, which
is a bit of a shame. The version that you can see of, in bootleg form of the first one is the full widescreen image, and the second one is cropped, but I did manage to find a version that was only cropped from the 2:35 image down to 1:85, so there's more of the image than in a 4:3. Thank goodness.
Oh, good.
But
also in that English, because the actual picture quality is really good. It's just a shame that it's missing the sides.
Mm-hmm.
But it is in English. But also, there's a bit in the final act where there's suddenly about 6 minutes just missing. There's a huge plot hole, and I was watching thinking, what the hell just happened?
Really?
But then I found an Italian, very poor quality copy on YouTube that has that missing scene in it. So I watched that in Italian, so I think I figured out what was going on. But yeah, there's a whole section missing, because suddenly I was like, what? This doesn't make sense. What's just happened? But I think a reel has dropped off it or something.
Oh, that's weird.
But yeah, so anyway, maybe that's why but I just feel like the directing is a bit flat in the second one. But anyway, we can get to that.
And yet I feel okay. Yeah, we it's good that we're on separate continents. It'd be a knife fight. So And my blood does not coagulate the way Super Argo's blood does.
That's true. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. let's discuss this before we go any further into plot. Okay, so one of the ways in which, in the first film, we learn about the amazing physical abilities of Super Argo is, the fellow who wants to turn him into, who essentially wants to enter Super Argo into special agent school. As far as I can tell, is therapy to save him from apparent depression and possible suicide because of his feelings of horror at having murdered one of his friends in the ring. There's a whole lot to talk about there if you want to delve into it, folks. But he stabbed him in the arm.
Maybe he wasn't such a cheat, then it wouldn't have happened. That's all I can say.
So maybe it is his fault. Maybe suicide is the answer, Super Argo.
But this guy is like, in the book, he calls him Colonel Kinski.
He does. But I don't think that's the name I remember.
I know. In the credits, it doesn't say, I can't see anyone called Colonel Kinski. There's a Colonel Kenton, so that might be the same.
In the English dub, I think that's the name. Yeah.
Anyway. Yes. Says, look, he says, I'm going to show you how cool Super Argo is, and then just stabs him.
Oh, I know. Stabs him in the arm.
And they're all shocked, and he's just like looking at his arm. Like, oh.
And then they take some of his blood, and I got to ask you, do you think that because it really does look like there's someone actually sticking a needle into our main character's arm, withdrawing blood, and
I think they just actually take a blood sample in real life.
which is odd. I love, and this is one of my minor things for films. I really do enjoy watching how they'll fake putting a needle into an actor. And there are a dozen different ways to do it. And it's great. I always like just, checking out how they're doing it, because I'm not looking for that level of verisimilitude. Go ahead and fake it, because there's no reason to stick a needle into an actor's arm. It's pointless. So when I see this and I'm going, I think they really did it. I wanted to make sure you thought that as well.
But if he can get blood out of his arm with a needle, why wasn't there blood on the knife when his friend just stabbed him in the arm?
Okay, you are using your logical brain, and you need to stop. That is not where we are, my friend. That is not the kind of film we're watching. You have stepped over the line.
Sorry about that. Yeah,
that's you need to back away. Think about what you said.
I'll put that back in the box.
Have someone go get a ruler and snap it across your hand, because, man, come on. But here's the thing. So they draw out his blood to demonstrate that it one of the great physical attributes that he has, which is that his blood coagulates very quickly, so he can get wounded and not really bleed to death. And there's a part of me that immediately threw up my arm and went, wait. won't this guy just die of a blood clot? I mean, what's keeping this from just killing him outright? I mean,
how is it still flowing?
Yeah. If it coagulates, I mean, there needed to be something in there about, once it leaves his, once it leaves his body, or once it's below like body temperature or something.
Contact with air or something.
Yeah. See, that would have been good. Oxygen maybe there.
Yeah.
Or no, you can't do that because blood is oxygenated. It would have to have been something else. Oh, God. This is getting more complex the more I think about it. We should step away.
But then they didn't really need for that to be one of his superpowers, because they just gave him a bulletproof suit anyway.
I know.
So that was pointless, really.
Oh, but it anyway. Was cool, and we got to stick a needle in the actor's arm.
He goes through a few tests to prove how he can withstand fire. He can withstand being frozen.
Mm-hmm.
He can also withstand being electrocuted. It just hurts.
Well, okay, look. He goes through being frozen, or from what it looks like, he goes through being covered in shredded coconut. I can't tell. So
it's like he's been sprayed with foam out of a fire extinguisher or something. Yeah. But because, I mean, it's lucky that they showed us that he can do that, because then later in the film we get to see it all over again.
Yeah, there's that attack with shredded coconut. No, I'm kidding.
He gets tortured later.
And that's why they show us that, so that we as the audience won't feel any concern at all when they're torturing him. Which one might expect that to have been a misstep, perhaps, if you're trying to maintain some level of tension.
one of the scene that's the sequence that's missing in the English language version of the second film, part of that is him being put into an Iron Maiden. There's like a torture chamber in the caves and he's put into an Iron Maiden, and then when they open the door again, all the spikes have bent. So he's quite a tough guy.
Yes, yes. Almost nothing can harm this man.
But again, is that his bulletproof suit that's made out of a special plastic? Mm-hmm. Or is it that his blood is so coagulated that it bends metal? It's not entirely sure how his superpowers work.
Well, I mean, he can definitely be stuck with a knife. And yeah. he does comment that, you know, he could be killed with a bullet, except for the bulletproof suit.
So yeah, except if anyone can aim for his face, I mean...
Well, you know, that is a standard concern for all non-masked superheroes throughout eternity. So,
yeah, but they give him this special plastic bulletproof suit. I just worried for him that it was going to be whether it was going to be breathable or not, because he never takes this thing off.
I know. I think he sleeps in it, for God's sake.
Yeah, and he swims in it, and he eats in it, he showers in it, never comes off.
In that respect, it is very much like the masked wrestler films from Mexico, where there is almost no indication at all in, say, an El Santo film that these guys take that mask off. I mean, I have seen El Santo films where I swear he is stepping out of a shower with the damn mask on. So
yeah,
maybe that's what we're leaning heavily into here as well.
Yeah, so let's get to the bad guy, Diabolicus, whose name is never explained, or why he's wearing an octopus on his special shiny suit is never particularly explained.
I know, it's true.
I mean, unless it's some kind of reference to Spectre, maybe.
Well, maybe. I mean, that's certainly something you could put into a film like this and get away with.
Yeah, he's basically a Bond villain. The film begins with him and his crew attacking a ship with their speedboats, like pirates, like Somali pirates, basically. They board with their machine guns. They steal all of the, mercury and uranium in the hold.
Mm-hmm.
And then they shoot everybody and head back to their secret island base, which is very much the whole thing is very James Bondy, because he's turning uranium and mercury into gold, which he's going to then use to flood the gold reserves. And I can't remember what the reason was for doing that. Was it to make gold worthless?
Oh, well,
back to the Stone Age or something?
Right. The whole idea is to completely destroy the monetary system of the world and then somehow or another, I can't remember the details, but this would allow him to essentially bring the governments of the world to their knees, and he would be able to do what he wanted to. But which is cool. And we should point out the first film came out in 1966. And so this movie plays a whole lot like a Eurospy film from this period. We're deep into Bond mania. The influence here is extremely strong, because this is, if this guy was running around without a mask and without this comical suit, this would just be a standard Eurospy film, to be honest. Maybe with some incredible guy at its center, but it has this is luchador movie crossed with Eurospy. Bingo, here's your film. And therefore, all the things that you would expect from one of those movies is here, including, you know, the island base, the supervillain, out for world domination. It's really strongly part of the Eurospy tradition, and that, I think, is one of the things that really puzzles me about why this isn't better known. I just think there needs to be a lot more attention paid on video releases from boutique labels to the whole Eurospy genre, and this would be part of it.
I don't want to say too much else about the plot, because we don't want to give too much away. And this is a film that people could quite easily find and watch, and it is fun.
Mm-hmm.
I said I've preferred this one to the second one, and maybe I can try and argue my case, I guess.
Well, I will just say, without really digging heavily into it, I would just say that, to be clear, I think this one is more flatly directed than the second one. I think the second one is much more much more ambitious in its choice of shots, in its movement of the camera, in the way that it pushes the story forward using the camera to kind of get everything moving and push. This one feels a little flat to me. I felt that, like I say, this is the first time I've gone and seriously considered these films for more than just, you know, eye candy entertainment. And so I'm thinking about these movies as I'm watching them for the first time. In other words, I'm really considering where they differentiate. And with this one, it feels too flatly directed, which is a charge that I could make about a lot of the lesser Eurospy films from the period. Whereas the second one, it feels like the director was trying to prove something. I mean, it seems like he really was leaning heavily into making a mark on this and playing it up with some dynamism in how he shot the film. And so for me, the second one moves so much more. The complaints that I see where people talk about these two films and prefer the first to the second, and I will give them this. The Super Argo character in the first film is a lot more of a complicated guy. I mean, seriously, I was not joking. He's very depressed at the beginning of this film after he accidentally kills his friend. And this whole enlisting him in the Secret Service to go be a secret agent thing can be read as both an exploitation of him, because, of course, what a resource, but also as a way to keep him from killing himself, to kind of save this man from a deep, dark funk. And that's interesting, I'll grant you that. It adds a level of interest to the story being told. But if you're just looking for an action film with kind of comic book overtones and the strangeness that can come from that being your source material, I like the second one. I mean, we're fighting robots, we're levitating, there's, you know, I mean, yeah, granted, yeah. The character Super Argo in the second film is not as interesting. There's not you can't read depth into the character in the second film the way you can in the first. But man, it moves like a shot. I enjoy the second one more.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, there's some really big sets. I do think it's basically Super Argo versus the Cybermen.
That was something that I kept thinking this time as well, whereas in previous viewings I had not really considered that, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it does. It feels a lot like, because there's a lot of just roaming around in the woods chasing men with robot masks.
Well, and in those things. Those amazing caverns, that set in those caverns.
Oh, the caves are really cool. I'm pretty sure I recognize those caves from other Italian films I've seen, though. They must be the same caves. But it felt at times it did feel like an episode of Doctor Who, because there's so much old Doctor Who is just men in costumes with masks chasing somebody in the woods. And of course, twice this week, including the second Super Argo, I've watched a film where somebody's fallen into quicksand.
Oh, I know, but they don't identify it in the film as quicksand.
It's like quicksand in the middle of a forest.
Which makes zero sense.
Yeah, it's more like a swamp, but they treat it like quicksand, which was pretty funny. Because I've also just been watching I watched Emmanuel and the Last Cannibals, which also features a quicksand scene. And it seems to come up with recurring regularity in these films. Is that
the
right word?
It's very strange. Recurring regularity.
Anyway, we could mention then, okay, well, yeah. So I agree. I can see your point. I guess, I don't know. I sort of feel like the second film, the motivations for the villain are a bit less clear. What's he going to do with these robots? Oh, it also reminded me of the Batwoman, the Mexican film.
Yes, I can see that.
There's a doctor kidnapping sports people to turn them into fishmen. And in this film, they are kidnapping sports people to turn them into robots. But why is he doing it? The robot's going to help him take over the world? I can't even remember what he wanted to do with them.
You know, now that you mention it, I can't either. But I'll be honest, I don't care. It's like, do I need to really remember the motivations of the villains in these Eurospy style films? It's like, this one's based on a Fumetti. Let's just roll. Go.
Fair enough. Yeah, the second film is a different director, mm-hmm. Paolo Bianchini, who has directed several films, none of which I'm particularly familiar with.
Okay.
Although he did do one of the Decameron sexy comedies, of course, like they all did. He also did a film that could feature in this season, but we haven't got time to fit them all in. He did a Superman comedy in 1979, so clearly based on the Christopher Reeve Superman films,
right,
called Super Andy, the Strong Brother of Superman. I mean, that sounds like it's got potential, doesn't it?
It has potential to make me groan and suffer, yes. Yes, indeed.
So, yeah, so I'm not particularly familiar with anything that Paolo Bianchini has done apart from this Super Argo film, which came quite early in his career. And again, the wrestling in this film, he does get to wrestle again, but this time it's a way of kind of trapping, because they're kidnapping wrestlers, so he mm-hmm. figures if he wrestles, then they might come and kidnap him, and that's how he's going to sort of find out what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But as you mentioned, in this film, he's learned some new tricks, because he's a little bit like the Beatles, because the last film was 1966, this is 68 now.
68, so. Yeah.
So like the Beatles, he's hooked up with a guru.
It's true.
He's been learning meditation, the kind of meditation that lets him read people's minds, kind of remote view,
yeah,
and levitate.
Now, for a lot of people...
I mean, that's definitely cheating. That's cheating in wrestling, for sure.
Oh, so you're going back to cheating. So your overall takeaway from the Super Argo films is Super Argo equal cheater, which is kind of... I did not expect you to go there. That's intriguing.
He would be banned by the International Olympics Committee.
Well, for a number of reasons, I'm sure. But yes, okay, I'm gonna give you that, which I'm really not wanting to give you. I'm going to admit to you that's not a direction that I ever wanted to go. But if you're going to go in that direction, okay, sure, I got you. let's talk a little bit about beyond the plot mechanics and the cheating of the main character in the story. The villain in this. Sometimes I see people talk about Guy Madison, who plays our supervillain in this one, as being much weaker than Gerard Tichy of the previous films. And I can see that to a degree, because he's not as kind of physically imposing to a degree.
No.
And then, you know, when he tries to go one-on-one in the third act with Super Argo, basically we're all just kind of trying to see how long it takes Super Argo to chop him in half and count the rings. So...
Yeah.
But the thing is,
throw him in a swamp,
or there is that spoiler alert. Jeez, God, there's no trusting you, man. There's just absolutely no trusting you.
He may or may not get thrown into a swamp. How about that?
You vagued that up enough. Good job. So the thing about Guy Madison is, I have seen him in a lot of films. I think first of all, he's a very good actor. I really enjoy watching him on screen. And I think that let's just put it this way: anybody who plays a character in The Beast of Hollow Mountain has got my vote. So the joys of watching him on screen is that he really presents well. He's good either playing a good guy or a bad guy. And here, I like the sly way in which he's playing this character quite a bit. Have you been familiar with Guy Madison before?
A little bit. I mean, I've definitely come across his films before. I mean, looking at the sort of list of the way his career went,
mm-hmm.
he very much seems like the kind of actor that Tarantino was basing Rick Dalton on.
Yes.
In Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, how he had this great career, and then by the 60s he's mainly in Westerns on television, and then he goes off to Europe and does a load of European stuff, including one of the Shatterhand Westerns.
Well, that, and he plays in...
You just talked about.
Yeah, he plays a character in a couple of the Sandokan films.
Yeah, and he's done some Eurospies, mm-hmm. including the LSD film that hopefully we're going to do.
You're so obsessed with season. LSD, Flesh of the Devil. Flesh of the Devil is the title, yeah. So.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then obviously turns up in something like this. Yeah, interesting, but predominantly I can see why. One Ton Ton, the dog who saved Hollywood, of course.
That is a legend. That is a legendary quote-unquote bad film that I've got to see one day.
I can see how he's probably had people would be more familiar with him on television in America than over here.
Maybe. I mean, he did different things, but most of his career was on the big screen. I mean, yeah, he turned up in an episode of Fantasy Island, but who didn't? So,
but then all of his war films and westerns would have just played on TV all the time, I'm guessing.
Probably so. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's interesting to see him turn up in this film as this sort of evil scientist who's basically, they're kidnapping wrestlers and sports people, hollowing them out and turning them into robots, which makes you wonder, if they're so good at building robots, why do they need to put them inside people in the first place?
I don't know. Is it just because they need the skin so that they present as human beings? I don't get it.
Yeah. And then they've got they're sort of faceless, the title, Faceless Giants. All they are is men with stockings over their heads. That's how they're doing the faceless thing. They've just got like a pair of tights on their head.
It had been so long since I'd rewatched this film, several years, that I kept waiting for the moment where somebody yanked that pantyhose off of one of these things' face. And we got a look at, you know, their kind of like dead white faces. Yeah. And that would be some kind of shock moment. But nope. That is not what this film is interested in.
Yeah. But yeah, you're right about the location work is really fun in this. Once we get out of the forest, into the caves, they've built all this cool sci-fi, mad science laboratory in these caves. We're also in caves in the first film, of course, when he infiltrates the secret island base where they've got all the uranium. He has to swim underwater into an underwater entrance and then comes up through all these caves. So caves play a prominent role in both the films and in many of the films we've covered on this podcast. They come up again and again, the same caves.
Well, did you recognize the female lead, Diana Loris?
Yes. Was she the one who was working with Professor Wand?
Yes.
Who's Guy Madison? She's the daughter. So, because, yeah, they find out that there was this scientist who's now in an asylum. He's gone mad because of the things that he invented, which is something to do with artificial hearts and organs.
Right. He was attempting to create artificial organs, and that is the work that the Guy Madison character built upon.
Yeah, his daughter is working with Guy Madison. I didn't particularly recognize her, but was she Spanish? Was she one of our Spanish cast?
Diana Loris, she was in a number of... yes, she is Spanish. She was in a number of films where she stands out for me, not the least of which is a fantastic role in Paul Naschy's Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll. Uh-huh. She's very, very good in that. She's in a strong female cast in that movie, and she's very good. But she was also in Amado de Osorio's Fangs of the Living Dead, and Jess Franco's Nightmares Come at Night, which I can also recommend.
I do recognize, just looking at her credits, she's in Operazione Goldman, also known as Lightning Bolt, the sort of Euro spy film by Margheriti. So I have seen that one.
Right. And so she has a role also in Franco's first horror film, The Awful Dr. Orloff, back in 62. She's a strikingly attractive woman. She is described as a redhead in this movie, and that does appear to be true. I'm not sure if that was her natural hair color or not, but she's an absolutely gorgeous and talented lady. And it was sad to realize that there was this massive gap in her career. She came back and did a movie in 2010, but it doesn't look like she retired from filmmaking in the late 70s. Okay. And that is a shame, because I've really enjoyed her in everything I've seen her in. And so, it's good to see her in this as well. The character has I won't say she doesn't have much to do, but she has only a few notes that she needs to hit, but it's good to see her in there doing what needs to be done.
Yeah, and she starts to doubt, doesn't she, as to whether what she's doing is actually a good idea, which is interesting.
She kind of turns and starts trying to defend Super Argo and keep him from keep him from being killed by the villain, and she kind of has a different vision than our supervillain, and that's neat. That sets up a nice tension between the two quote unquote bad guys.
Because there's a bit in the English one, at one point, Kamir or Kabir, whatever is however they pronouncing it, his guru, who's basically like his sidekick. He's also because they discover they discover that they can fight these robots with laser guns. So they head back to fight them with their laser guns, and they're shooting, and he's shooting. They're both shooting these robots,
zapping them in the chest.
Yeah, but then Kabir falls into the swamp and has to be rescued. And whilst Super Argo is trying to rescue him, they get captured by the robots, and they end up in a cell, and that's when they face torture and all this kind of stuff. And that's where there's a whole chunk that suddenly disappears in the English language version. But, yeah, and then, yeah, like I said before, he gets put into a Iron Maiden. They're drawing on... It's almost like they're drawing on the heritage of the Gothic. Like, it's a scientific lab in a cave, but he's also got an Iron Maiden, which is particularly...
I know. This film has a lot of different visual... A lot of different visual things it's drawing from it. It's really kind of odd.
Yeah. Well, you've won me round.
Oh, well, I didn't mean to do that. stand your ground, Adrian. Fight me.
Never mind. yeah, I mean, they're both good fun. And his costume is very much kind of drawing on a little bit Diabolic, but also a little bit sort of the Phantom, I guess.
Yeah,
that kind of thing as well. This one isn't a comic, so whereas Criminal, that we talked about last time, was based on a Fumetti, this was a character who's like... I read somewhere, I think it was Roberto Curti's book, he said that this was Italy's first superhero, like that he was written specifically for the screen rather than adapting from a comic, but clearly drawing on the sort of comic style with some of the things that he does. But interesting, I wondered whether with the second film, where they're trying to cash in on the connections to Diabolic by one of the alternative titles being The King of Criminals, because obviously that's kind of what Diabolic was known as. So I don't know, it's a bit odd, but he is a hero, so it doesn't really make any sense.
It doesn't.
As far as I can tell, the first film didn't get a release in the UK, and I couldn't find any evidence of any American reviews either. But the second film seems to have had more distribution on VHS and stuff as well. And I found a review in it was released in the UK, but weirdly, not until 1975.
Really?
So yeah, it came out over here 7 years later, distributed by Fox. And so I looked up the review, and brilliantly, the review is written by my friend David McGillivray, which is hilarious. He was right. He did a lot of reviews for Monthly Film Bulletin back in the 60s and 70s. David McGillivray is the same guy who wrote Satan's Slave and Terror and House of Whipcord and Frightmare and, you know, all that cool stuff. And I interviewed him for the Norman J. Warren book, and I've got to know him a little bit, and I've been to his house, and he's a really nice guy. Anyway, so it turns out he wrote the review of Super Argo back in 1975. Il Re dei Criminali, as it says in here, a.k.a. Super Argo and the Faceless Giants. I'll just read you what he says. In the hierarchy of superheroes, Super Argo, little more than a bruiser in a bulletproof leotard, must rate lower than Jungle Jim. Appropriately enough, he is accompanied on his adventures by one of the most morose of sidekicks and pitted against one of the most harmless-looking villains, Guy Madison, completely miscast. The routine, Bond-flavoured action flows consistently enough to please easily pleased children, but comic strip aficionados will find even less to arouse them here than in Doc Savage.
Oh, wow. So they're comparing it to the 1975 Doc Savage film. So okay.
I mean, it's a bit late, 1975.
Very.
I can see the film doing better in the 60s.
Maybe. I would like to say that clearly I am one of the easily pleased children because I enjoy this film.
Well, yeah, we all. That's why we're here.
we're both. I think we both often fit into that category, Adrian.
Yeah. So. Talking seriously about films that most people stopped watching when they were about 14.
Or stopped watching about 15 minutes into.
Yeah, well, that's true as well. But speaking of which, I think the second Super Argo, wasn't it on Mystery Science Theater at some point?
Oh my goodness, I can't remember. I think one of them was.
Because I think the second film did have better distribution outside, with its English language version, so outside of Europe.
Okay.
So I think that's probably why that one has shown up a bit more. Whereas the first Super Argo turned up on the German version of Mystery Science Theater. So, yeah, there you go.
Well, I will admit that I know that the Riff Tracks fellows, the guys who were part of the Mystery Science Theater family, did a Riff Track for the second film. And I have put that to the side for future listening, because I didn't want to listen to it to kind of taint myself and to talk about this film without having the jokes in mind. But I am looking forward to rewatching the second film with the Riff Tracks guys making fun of it. That will be fun.
Yeah, I should probably have a look at that as well. Well, there you go. So there we are. Super Argo double bill. Fun for all the family.
Well, now I have a question for you. This is our second episode of this season. In both cases, the villain in the first one, hero in the second one, only managed to eke out two cinematic adventures, and I'm a little surprised. I'll be clear about this as we go on through these films as we continue this series. This is not the way things play out. I think we may have inadvertently kind of front loaded the ones that did get a sequel, because I don't think many of them did, because I think the Eurospy genre that they're really kind of a part of, this kind of a subset of them, I think they burned themselves out pretty hard and fast. But if there are more sequels coming, I don't think there were many. I think there may have been like one reoccurring or two reoccurring like Eurospy guys. But as far as the Fumetti films, I think these are the ones with sequels. Are there any more that you're aware of?
Not really. Not that I've got on the list anyway. They are all standalone films. I mean, because our next episode is going to be about Argo Man, the Fantastic Superman. And that one, I think, really did deserve some sequels but didn't get any, which is a shame. But considering the popularity of the comics that some of these did come from, and obviously Danger Diabolic is the obvious one where there should have been sequels at the time. But even something like Satanic and Avenger X, I think that one's from a comic, like, you would have thought that there would have been more of an appetite for it. But like you said, maybe just because the Eurospy thing was such a huge but short-lived genre that they just sort of fizzled out with it.
I suppose. Yeah, that's the only thing that I can think of as an explanation.
It's basically from 1966 to 69, and then I've thrown in an extra one from 1974 at the end, the Super Stooges versus the Wonder Woman.
which I am so looking forward to revisiting.
I know, because I'm basically a sadomasochist, so I'm inflicting it on both of us.
You've decided to pull out the torture devices there at the end.
But just in the last few years in Italy, there's been a new Diabolic trilogy. So the third Diabolic film's just coming out this year, called, I think it's next month.
And I've not seen any of those. So.
Well, I'm going to send you the first one so you can watch it. We'll talk about that at the end of the season.
You are a sweet, sweet man.
But yeah, Diabolic Kisei, or Diabolic Who Are You, is coming out soon. So that's that's happened now, but clearly back in the 60s would have been better to have had a few more. But yeah, it's a shame. So you're right. We've done two sets of sequels, but from now on, we are just standalone films, which might make for slightly shorter episodes as well.
Maybe so, but we'll see. I'm sure we'll find reasons to bet.
I'm excited to talk about Argo Man, the Fantastic Superman, next time. That is a film.
I'm not gonna lie. I love that movie. I can't wait to talk about it.
It's gonna be really fun. Well, thank you everybody for being with us to cover Super Argo. I think hopefully we've done him justice. I think overall, we like him. even if he, even if the Olympic Committee are not so keen. Yeah, so we've got Argaman coming up. In the meantime, do subscribe to us on YouTube, leave us a review. Oh, and thank you to people who have left us reviews. I discovered the other day how to find reviews on Apple, but it makes you look for it by individual country. So I managed three countries, and there's like another 250 countries to go, so it might take me a while to find all the reviews. But somebody in Australia left us a review, so thank you very much if you're listening, and that was you. Get in touch. We'd love to talk to somebody in Australia.
Certainly.
And then also some reviews in America and UK reviews. So if that was any of you listening, thank you very much for that. We really appreciate that. If I can find a way to see the reviews on Apple more easily than having to look at each individual country, that might help, because maybe there's some more that I just don't know about. But yeah, if you want to get in touch with us, we are on Instagram, we are on Twitter, and email at which is just wildwildpodcast@gmail.com. Mark got in touch with us just today, actually. It's almost like he knew we were recording today, to suggest that we could think about doing a Tinto Brass season. Because Tinto Brass is all the rage these days. His films are starting to get 4K releases. There's been a new Caligula cut just come out.
True.
And there is a big coffee table book just coming out about Tinto Brass. Now, for me, I am slightly hesitant. I'd have to be very specific, I think, about which Tinto Brass films I'd want to cover.
Okay.
Because, you know, they very easily just tip into...
porn.
In fact, well, yeah, okay, yes. There's too many naked ladies on the covers of those films for me to bring them into the house. And I definitely couldn't own a Tinto Brass coffee book. That would
be... I can understand, but, yes, of course.
But I do like his early 60s films. Like, Deadly Sweet is a kind of comic book-inspired giallo that's really good, set in swinging London.
Well, see, that's the thing, is my knowledge of Tinto Brass's career is very limited. I've only dipped my toes into some of the more obvious things that kind of veer into the near pornographic realm. So it would be a way to educate myself on his career and his films. So that would be fun.
Have you ever seen Salon Kitty?
Yes, years ago. Yes.
Yeah.
That one got a DVD release over here. Yeah. You know, years and years ago. Goodness. So.
There are some things I saw in that film that are seared into my brain.
Do they mostly involve naked men doing athletic things?
Oh no, it's more. Oh no, I don't want to. I don't want to say it out loud while people are listening, because
I understand.
I don't want to upset anybody who might be eating their lunch whilst listening to this.
Okay. Well, then I think I have a suspicion. Okay.
Anyway, thanks, Mark. That's a great suggestion. I might add it to the list of future. Perhaps not a full, you know, 6 month season, but maybe a mini season. That could work.
That could be fun.
Yeah. So yes, Rod, you just recently had an episode out about the 60s Edgar Wallace. Not Edgar Wallace. I'm obsessed with Edgar Wallace. Let me start that again. You have an episode out about the 60s Dr. Mabuza films.
Yes, yes.
Which I enjoyed listening to. I do own the first one of those on Blu-ray, and I haven't watched it yet, so you're encouraging me to hurry up and watch that.
Oh, I think they're all, bar the very last one, I think well worth seeing. I think the last one really does fall down pretty hard, but they're, you know, when you have a series of six films, I think that it's, you know, eventually the quality is going to flag. Sure. But those 60s Mabuza films are a great entertainment, and I was able to speak with my buddy Holger Haase over the interwebs, and the joys of talking about those movies are multitudinous. Glad you enjoyed the show. Yeah, we got the show's a little over 2 hours long, and we knew it was going to be tough to kind of talk about all six of those movies within a certain period of time. So we do apologize for the length, but man, come on, it's six movies.
Yeah, no, it was good. I need to watch them. He also, because he did, as well as his little book that you talked about, he wrote a big magazine article recently as well about that. So yeah, he knows his stuff. Anything else that you want to plug? Anything upcoming that you want people to be aware of?
The next episode of The Bloody Pit will be coming out in a week or two, which is focused on the amazing Paul Bartel film Eating Raoul. If you've never seen it, you should. If you have seen it, you'll know why we're talking about it, because it is very funny. And well, any chance to talk about Mary Warnoff is a good reason to have a conversation. So, my Patreon is perking along. I call it Rod's Rants and Reviews. Not a lot of ranting on there. Mostly, I treat it as a way to once again speak to people who are crazy enough to actually want to pay $3 a month to listen to me talk about silly things for 10 or 15 minutes. And so this week past several weeks, I've been shocked by how much I enjoyed the recent Dungeons and Dragons film. I've talked a little bit about Boston Blackie movies from the 1940s, and then also laid out why I was disappointed with the recent film release of the film release Argyle. So it swings all over the place, people.
Oh, very good. So you do watch films from the 21st century?
All of the time.
Not just the old stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, if you get the opportunity, everyone, highly recommend Suitable Flesh from last year. Very much an excellent H.P. Lovecraft adaptation. Really pleased with that film. Very well done.
Oh, there we go. Modern recommendations. What is this podcast coming to?
Oh, I know.
Okay, well, on that note, let's say goodbye. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back again soon. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.